This is Professor Allen. And welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will more or less select at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents, or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 175th episode of the Quarterbin Podcast, we're looking at the Twilight Zone number 2 from Now Comics, cover dated December 1991. But first, a little feedback. Chris from Professor Frenzy said this was a show. I got that reference, Chris. The guys at Star Rocket Radio, the new Infinity Inc. podcast, said they couldn't wait to listen. Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit said it was a great episode. Thank you. Made my commute more pleasant. And thanks for the bonus banking lesson. Well, Drew, education, it's what I do. A social media love for last episode came from Clinton, from Fan Film Fridays, Sir Luke, Laurel Mountain Flower from the Hunters Podcast, Chris Lydon, Karen from the Sweet Blog Between the Pages, James from Karen, Billy D from Magazines and Monsters, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Max Reads Comics, Sean from Secret Wars and Beyond, Al Sedano from the Warlock Thanos podcast, Derek William Crabb from the Fanholes, Chris Willett, Gene Hendricks, Sir Iowa's Joe from the 21st Century Boys podcast, and our listeners of the year, the kind and lovely Sutherlands from the Rad Adventures Network. And before we move on, I want to correct something that I am going to say in about 35 minutes, but which I actually said about 2 months ago. In case you didn't know, podcasting totally involves time travel. You see, the book I mention at the end of this episode as the one we're going to cover next episode, that book is actually going to be bumped into the middle of next year sometime. What we are actually going to cover next time in episode 176 is the Savage She-Hulk number 5 from Marvel Comics, cover dated June 1980. I thought about just re-recording that info and dropping it right into the episode later, but the bulk of this episode is a conversation with a guest, and the audio quality of those is different from this more studio sound. So I didn't want that to be a distraction. But the accountant in me, more the auditor in me to be precise, could not let that error stand. Or actually, let that change of my mind stand. All right, time to take a break. And when we come back from this promo, it will be me and guest Paul Spatero, and we'll be entering the Twilight Zone.
When you watched Batman as a kid, you enjoyed the colorful heroes and villains, the text sound effects on the screen, the thrill of watching a heroic crime fighter escaping from death traps and taking down bad guys. But the show was devised to interest adults, too. What did you miss as a kid? Sexual innuendo.
The penguin's too small for me.
Closeted gay characters.
I like that cape, Batman.
Freudian death traps.
Has the giant clam really swallowed Robin?
Police incompetence.
Bruce Wayne is a millionaire playboy. Hardly a secret identity for Batman.
Whether you're a kid or an adult, there's something to like about our favorite Caped Crusader. Tim and Paul dig for the deeper meanings under the Batmania every first, third, and fifth Thursday of the month. What's the podcast's name?
To
the Batpoles. To the Batpoles. To the Batpoles.
And we're back. And this is a follow-up of sorts of an episode of Back to the Bins, where brought to the table an issue of the Whitman run of Twilight Zone. That was back on episode 444, released in December of 2020. So when I found this issue, Twilight Zone number 2 from Now Comics, in a cheap bin, I think possibly at a 10-cent sale, I knew that episode 175 was the right time to talk about this, because a little math here, friends, 175 is divisible by 25. And every 25th episode, except for episode 25, when that was too early and I didn't know what I was doing. But since then, every 25 episodes, we've been visited by our friend from Back to the Bins and many other podcasts as well, Mr. Paul Spatero, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here as always. Well, kind of.
What? Often. More times than not. Let's go with that. Okay. Now, I
wanted to ask you, though, is it appropriate to have a 10-cent comic on Quarter Bin?
You and Shag, you can just take your technicalities. What are you? Some kind of lawyer or something?
I'm part of the bins police.
Part of the legal industrial complex. I don't need your pickiness and attention to detail. Okay.
All right, well, for what it's worth, 10 cents. I think we should cover 2.5 issues, but we're only covering one.
Okay. Now, I can't remember us getting together every 25 episodes. I know this is one of our regular court-mandated check-ins, but am I your probation officer or are you mine? I can't remember the details. It's kind of...
I think we have the wool pulled over the eyes of everybody, and they don't realize that we're both running free.
We are on the lam.
I'd be hard pressed to come up with two guys much less likely to be on the lam.
Especially now with you laid up with an injured foot.
Yeah, as I sit here with my foot elevated and in a giant boot. It's a pleasure to have anyone to speak to, even you.
Let's just see if we can elevate the conversation, okay? So other than that one issue we covered on Back to the Bins, have you read much in the Twilight Zone comic range? And I assume you've watched a fair amount of the TV show?
I've watched every episode of the TV show at some point or another. I do have a copy of the Twilight Zone Companion sitting on my bookshelf behind me here, somewhere on the bookshelf. I'd have to do a little searching to find it, but I definitely have it. I've always been kind of a fan of that genre. So I have that. But as far as reading the comic books, not so much. I don't have any active recollection of reading any actual Twilight Zone stories other than the two that we're referencing. I've read stories that are akin to Twilight Zone, you know, the old Marvel horror stories and such. But yeah, no actual issues of the Twilight Zone. I'm sure there's some really good ones, and I'm sure there's some god-awful ones.
Yeah, I can imagine. This one, Twilight Zone number 2 from Now Comics, had a cover price of $1.95, meaning I acquired it with my super special 10-cent price at almost a 95% discount.
Do you want to feel even better about that?
How much did you pay for yours, Paul?
No. No such worries there. But I looked it up on eBay and saw it going for $3.
Ah, perfect. Nailed it.
Buy it now.
Rush out now in a buying frenzy, read it, and then listen to it. You can follow along with the rest of the episode. The cover of this comic is a mix of browns and bronzes, I guess. Sort of in the background, we see some violent bits of graffiti spray painted onto a wall. And in the foreground, we see a skull, blindfolded, wearing what looks like a leather jacket. Fonzie is having a pretty bad day.
See, from the cover, even though, you know, you're describing the leather jacket, when I see the skull with the blindfold, I'm thinking pirates. I'm thinking skull and do-rag at the top.
Yeah, exactly.
My initial thought would be a pirate story.
Right.
I would not notice the leather jacket and the images in the background. Like, I wouldn't notice that that's graffiti so much as just background images.
Okay, spoilers. I didn't notice the leather jacket till after I read the story. And I certainly wouldn't have thought of that necessarily as graffiti until after reading the story. So it is one of those cases. Yeah, it is one of those cases where actually reading it makes the cover make a little more sense, actually.
Because of that, it makes the cover somewhat misleading.
If you think you're getting something else.
Yeah, if you're, you know, a young kid and your mom gives you $2 to go buy a comic book and you say, ooh, let me get this pirate story, you might come home and be sorely disappointed.
Yes. I mean, the colors, they are ominous. There's not a lot of brightness except for the logo. But I think it does have an air of mystery or drama, a little bit of horror. It's, I think, tonally it works more than narratively, perhaps. We can put it that way.
I'll go with you there. and I don't think this is a book that is intended to appeal to the 10-year-old with $2.
Right.
I think this is more intended to get an audience of people who are upwards of 35.
And
are familiar with the Twilight Zone TV show to the extent that they would pick this book up, if nothing else, thinking, oh, it's going to bring back the feelings of the original show.
Right.
And spoiling ahead, it does do that, in my opinion.
Well, the story, Blind Alley, was written by J. Michael Straczynski with art by Todd Fox and Enrique Villagran. And now, cards on the table, Paul, I have a confession to make. And that is that I am, by nature, very pleasantly disposed towards JMS. It was a few years after this issue that he gave me my favorite long-form TV show of all time, Babylon 5. And because of that, I do give him a very wide berth.
Do you forgive him for the Spider-Man story in which Gwen Stacy had twins fathered by Norman Osborn?
No comment. I do not go out of my way to criticize. If I don't like, I pass over. I try to avoid the negatives. I understand that lots of comic book fans, Spider-Man and Superman and Wonder Woman, probably a longer list than that, have less positive thoughts about JMS's comic book work. And I totally understand that. And you are welcome to rip him if you think this story deserves it. But the fact that I'm covering it here is kind of a clue that I more or less like the story. So I mean, that's kind of a spoiler, I guess. But I just wanted to make my biases clear. So the story starts at a book signing. And there we meet best-selling author Edward Morrell promoting his new book, Street Scene. This is something that Em and I have both talked about before, and that's our fear or concern, hesitancy when a writer writes a story about a writer writing a story. It's a recipe for potential self-indulgence. So at this point, my antennae are up. I have to admit that. Morrell's strength as a writer is his ability to write realistic street toughs, to portray the ins and outs of gang life. The people he writes about seem real to readers. During the signing at one point, and then in the taxi cab afterwards, he sees a vision of a younger street tough, a gang member, a kid who seems to know him very well. It's a convention of street wisdom that what goes around comes around. It's a long way from back alleys to book publishers, from ripoffs to royalties. But as Edward Morrell is about to discover, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. And this one runs through a dimly lit alley in the Twilight Zone. Morrell's plane to New York City is delayed and he gets rerouted through Newark, his hometown. He continues to see these visions, even interrupting a bathroom drug deal at one point. On the plane, he confesses to a fan that he used to run with a gang back in 57. The Laughing Gentleman. I was 17, just a kid. He dozes off and recalls a rumble that his Laughing Gentleman had with the Hawks. They won't be Hawks no more, Eddie says, demonstrating his skill in using language. They'll be the Chicken Hawks. But the rumble, as they said in Star Wars, was a trap. And the fighting got up close and personal. Eddie at one point finds himself on top of one of the Hawks, knife in his hand. But he couldn't do the deed. He dropped the knife and high-tailed it out of there. Eddie, traitor, we'll get you, Eddie. Waking up on the plane in a cold sweat, Eddie finds a phone booth inside the airport, calls his wife, tells her how he swore he'd never go back to Newark. But they got me when I wasn't looking. He sees another vision of one of the old gang guys welcoming him home. Not able to escape, he eventually confronts the vision. Recognize the old neighborhood, Eddie boy? Hasn't changed much, has it? Looks almost the same as it did that night. We're buddies, right? Laughing gentlemen forever, right? You really don't get it, do you, Eddie boy? Leave me alone, he tells the apparition. You're dead. Get away from me. Turns out that Eddie is here because he never left and because he and the gentleman have unfinished business. Now, at this point, we should point out that the other guys in the gang look 17, while Eddie is his adult age of 40-something or whatever. The gang gives him another chance to do what's right, and he picks up a knife from the street, and suddenly his suit and tie are back to jeans and a leather jacket. I don't want to be here, man. The scene replays from Eddie's dreamed recollection with him repeating the Chicken Hawk line, and then unfolds the same, even with him dropping the knife and fleeing. This time, back in his suit and tie, he stumbles into the present and finds himself accosted by three current day toughs. And a knife is drawn on him. But out of the fog, out of the past, his old crew appears. Back off. He's ours. And those guys flee, and Eddie finally is asked the question. Why did you run back then, Eddie? Because I knew that if I stuck the guy, somebody'd get me and I'd end up dead in that place and nobody would understand. They'd shake their heads, say how terrible our life was. And they'd go onto the sports page and they'd never understand. They'd never know why we did it, who we were. And the ghost, gentleman, understands. That's the whole point. That's why you're here. All these years, you've been making yourself crazy. That's why we brought you back. So you'd remember you didn't cut out because you were afraid. You just didn't want to die without anybody understanding. You lived, got out of here, made good. You're a writer. You made them understand, made them feel what it's like. You brought it to them and you made it real. Nobody said much at my funeral. Priest mumbled a few things. The stone gave my name, date of birth. But man, you wrote us the best epitaph anyone could. It's like we didn't die for nothing, you know? You kept us alive in the words. But all the time you were putting out this guilt, we felt that too. This was our turn to make you understand. No more bad feelings. We'll have to do this all over again. Got it? Eddie, or Edward, he waves goodbye to the ghosts of his past. And one of them calls out to him mocking, Mr. Morrell, can we have your autograph? And on the last page, our author picks up a can of spray paint and tags a wall with Edward Morrell. No comment necessary except to observe that sometimes, just sometimes, it's possible for a man to step out of the darkness and carve himself a little corner of peace and light. even in the back alleys, whose names are known only in the Twilight Zone. The end. So big picture, Paul, what did you think of this one?
I really liked it. I liked it more than I thought it was going to. As it went on, I kind of had this image of where the story was going to go. Mm-hmm. I expected that Eddie Murrell was going to end up in some sort of a deadly cycle where this was just going to keep repeating itself over and over again, or that he was just going to end up having to be there and be dead.
Right.
So the ending was not what I anticipated, to my happiness. It didn't give me what I want, so it bothers me. It didn't give me what I want, and I feel that they improved on it by not giving me my expectations.
Right.
I could hear in the narration, I could hear Rod Serling's voice mm-hmm. do this story. Mm-hmm. So it felt like an episode. It also, you know, having his past thing be, you know, 1957, you're figuring this story probably takes place around roughly 1975, 1980, mm-hmm. even though it's a much more recent book than right. that. So that gave it kind of a vintage feel to it. It didn't bring you back to the early 60s where the mm-hmm. Twilight Zone would have taken place, but when Twilight Zone was on the air, rather. Right. But it still gave it a vintage feeling and a feeling of nostalgia. Overall, I'm very happy with the story is the bottom line.
Yeah, I was, like I said, I was cautious about a writer writing about a writer. And this does reflect that. We get a story about the power of story, the power of writing. It's a common theme, and you can see why writers like writing about it. It's not a terrible theme, but there is a little bit of a twist in this one, and I do like that. And for a Twilight Zone story in particular, I think it worked. Again, simplistically, like you said, the opening and closing narration isn't bad. You know, Twilight Zone needs to have that opening and closing hook. It's part of the formula. I mean, that's not a bad thing. It's just part of the formula. And on the bigger picture, the story did have the nice twist on it. See, I assumed, you know, the old gang is coming out of the past to get revenge on Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the most obvious version of the story. You know, there are some sub places you can go off of that, but I didn't think they'd be there to protect him and to encourage him and then to thank him for his work on their behalf. So that twist, that also helps make it a Twilight Zone story for me. But again, anytime a writer writes about a writer being a hero, you do get a little nervous, but I think that was handled pretty well.
Again, I haven't read many Twilight Zone comics, and we did do that one that we, I don't even remember where we fell on the spectrum on it, but I think we overall kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But I suspect, and that's all it is because I haven't read them, but I suspect that there's more misses than hits in the Twilight Zone comic books, which is probably why I haven't read many of them, because I just don't anticipate them being really, really good.
Yeah.
So, you know, that said, I think this one hits the notes. I think it gives me, the bottom line is it gives me the feel of the series. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing that would have made it even more so is if it had been in a black and white magazine instead of color.
Right.
I think it might have benefited from that if it was in black and white, because I think it would have created, you know, as somebody who is a fan of the show, it would have created more of the feeling of the show for me. Now, I don't know if that would make it more popular commercially,
right,
but for me personally, it would have.
Interesting you say that, because JMS does have a history with the Twilight Zone property before this. Now, this comic was somewhere about like the fifth comic book story ever published. But before that, he was involved in the mid to late 80s revival of the Twilight Zone TV show.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 3 seasons, it looked like, and he was on the writing staff for 2 of those and wrote about 10 of the episodes. So he did have a feel for at least what that version of the Twilight Zone property was. And by the way, I was poking around on IMDb for that 80s, late 80s version. And mm-hmm. this is a pretty amazing writing staff. Future Farscape creator Rockne S. O'Bannon, Alan Brennert, George R. R. Martin, JMS, among many others, wrote for that version. I was like, every episode I clicked on had writers that I'd heard of.
Then
so they did a good job of putting together a staff on that one.
Absolutely, absolutely. So
it might make it more enticing to see if that series can be revisited.
Like I said, certainly has some skilled writers involved with it. You know what they did with that, and who knows from there. I do know that in Straczynski's recent memoir called Becoming Superman, which I do recommend if anyone wants to learn about the life of a writer. He wrote TV, movies, animation, comics. More recently, he's written a novel or two. But in that, he talks about how much he loved Twilight Zone and that he had a positive, really meaningful interaction with Rod Serling when Straczynski was maybe like 15 or so. I cannot remember the exact details, but it was something like maybe either Serling was doing a public appearance and JMS slipped him a short story, or Serling may have been a judge in a writing contest, something like that. But Serling gave him some time and gave him some writing advice, you know, something like that. And so when there was a revival of the Twilight Zone, he made that a mission to become a writer on staff. And by that point, Rod Serling had been dead for a decade or so. But his widow, Carol Serling, remained involved and executive producer-ish on various versions of the Twilight Zone, at least involved in that, in the legacy of the property. And, you know, JMS reports that she was really just delighted to hear about this impact that Serling had on JMS's life. And JMS and Mrs. Serling remained friends until she passed away just a few years ago, around the age of 90. So it is cool that he's a fan of Twilight Zone. And that's, you know, clearly why he got picked to write a comic, you know, after having written some episodes of that version of the show.
I think it's also cool that, you know, it's just cool when you hear of creators that you respect or that you like their work. And in this instance, I'm thinking of Serling. It's cool when you hear of them, you know, paying it forward.
Right, right. Taking some time to talk to a young kid writer.
I think there's something really to be said for that, because I think it's very easy once you've hit, you know, the lofty status to just kind of turn your back on everybody except for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, I think it's really easy to do that. It's kind of, when you think about it, it's a little despicable. So when you hear people who rise above it, when the only reason that they're rising above it is because they're choosing to.
Right.
You know, there's something to be said for that.
That's a good point. Sometimes it doesn't always work when a fan gets to take over a property or write on a property. But at least for this issue, I think it worked reasonably well. Reasonably well.
Oh, I definitely think it did. I like the artwork. I think we should touch on that.
Yes, definitely.
And what I said is absolutely true. I think this story would benefit from being in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, you just, it would require a little bit more shading work, but I think it would create a more moody feel for it. You know, this is the coloring of the 90s or 2000s, rather. No, this is the 90s, right? This is 91, I believe this book came out. So what it has is that slightly overbright, computerized feel to the coloring. And mm-hmm. I think, again, with you know, just take these images as is, make them black and white, and then add a little judicious shading to make it just a touch more moody.
Right.
And I think this story would be even a notch better.
Yeah. This is Now Comics. This is at best, on their best day, they were a third level comic book company. So I think that might be some of what you're seeing with the coloring, or maybe even with some of the backgrounds that aren't that, I mean, it's a low budget operation is what I'm trying to get at.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, it looks like they were primarily licensed products, which mm-hmm. means that whatever they made on every book, they had to pay a certain amount just right. for the license.
Right.
So that cut into their profit margin some, which, you know, it's going to make them more of a low budget company right. by necessity.
Yeah, I don't have the chronology, but I think Now did some black and white comic. I don't know if that was before or after, or if part of the deal with Twilight Zone was either to get the license they promised to do it in color or vice versa.
Well, I think from a marketing point of view, yeah. I think color would be much more easily marketed in 1991. Yeah. I'm saying black and white would be an improvement aesthetically,
right?
But I don't know if it would be more. I doubt that it would get them a bigger audience,
right?
You know, from a business point of view, making this in color is the right choice, in my opinion.
Right.
From a artistic point of view, I think black and white would have been the right choice.
Yeah. You know, to me, there's some stiffness in the art here and there, but again, for a pretty low-end publisher, I think for that, it's not bad.
I like the image, which gets repeated, of the four gang members walking towards right. the confrontation. I can almost hear like the Twilight Zone, not the intro music, but right. the in-episode music playing while I'm looking at that. Mm-hmm. It creates a feel, and
right.
that feel, again, as a fan of the series, is very, very welcome. Mm-hmm. You know, changing the topic slightly, I told you I have the Twilight Zone companion. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting because I had bought that around the same time that I bought the first Star Trek companion. And they go through, you know, episode by episode.
Right.
And the Star Trek companion, every episode, it's, oh, this one was wonderful because of this. This one was wonderful because of that. Bill Shatner does this in this episode, and you have to right. appreciate it. And that's all well and good. And I appreciate the perspective. But they pretty much, at least in that version, I don't know if it's changed over the years because that's a long time ago, but that version didn't critique or criticize anything. All they did was right. point out positives. You take the worst Star Trek episode and they're going to say, this is why it was good. The Twilight Zone companion, in contrast, you know, went over every episode. And some episodes they would say, this episode makes no sense because this, you know, or the acting here, right. you know, you'll see a mistake in the filming here because you see the other cameraman or the, right. the microphone or whatever. Like they pointed out the positives and the negatives of the series, which is something I always appreciate. Mm-hmm. And I remember spending time sitting with that book and kind of going through it episode by episode. Did I see this one? Did I see this one? And then, right. you know, at the time they were showing the Twilight Zone on the Sci-Fi channel. I think it was Sci-Fi channel. It might've been something else, but whenever there would be an episode on that I hadn't seen, I would set the timer on my VCR. You know, I would look ahead and then in TV Guide or whatever form of listings that I had available back at that time and make sure that I saw every episode. And the tough ones to see back then were the hour-long ones. They only right. showed those kind of on special occasions. But at some point or another, I've seen every Twilight Zone episode of the original run.
Right, right.
And now you've got me intrigued to see the 80s series.
And you're right, here in 91, I'm looking at the Now Comics house ad, and it does advertise that all of these are full color. So it may have been moving away from their black and white, but they have three Green Hornet titles, the real Ghostbusters, Married with Children, and the Twilight Zone, all licensed properties.
I don't know what the going rate on books was at that time. These are all $1.95, but if you right. were picking up a Marvel or a DC book in this particular month, I don't know if it was more or less or about the same, but they certainly couldn't afford to go significantly higher than anything Marvel and DC was putting out and expect to have a mass audience.
Right.
And as I said, they needed to pay off their license. So by necessity, I think a company like this is forced to seek out young, hungry talent right. and just do their best to get people who are talented.
My understanding is that a lot of the licenses, one of the reasons they don't run very long is that they tend to have escalator clauses, or when they get renegotiated after, you know, a year or two or three, that licensing fee tends to go up. And so you usually get a license for a couple of years, or, you know, a set period of time. And then, especially if it's a small company like this, they can't afford to renew it. So the license lapses and then may get picked up. I believe the Twilight Zone currently or recently was either published by, I want to say IDW, that could have been Dynamite. And I do think JMS wrote wrote for the maybe a 2015 or 2018 comic version of The Twilight Zone. So again, it's one of those properties that sort of falls in and out of various comic book publishers, like a lot of those licenses.
I'm going to answer the ultimate question probably earlier than you want me to, but well worth the 10 cents you paid for it.
But the trick question, Paul, is it worth a quarter? Because we're not doing grades. We don't grade the covers. We don't grade the art.
No.
No, nothing silly like that. It's not back to the bins. Sad. We like to think of the Quarter Bin Podcast as pass or fail. So is this comic book worth a quarter?
Well, I'm gonna pick up on our conversation from Back to the Bins recently, which should have aired before this, and say, well worth a quarter. Well worth it. The problem I would have is, what trapdoor is that opening for me if I have this? I spend a quarter on this, and then do I fall down the well and start seeking out all of the issues of this particular series, which may, you know, which I might be able to get for a dollar total. I don't know. I have no idea what they go for. I assume that none of them are particularly pricey.
I would imagine.
You know, again, picking up the thread from that conversation, this is the perfect book to buy, read, and then pass on to a friend to read.
I mean, with that,
you don't, nice, there's really no need to keep it.
And the nice thing is, The Twilight Zone should fit into that category. I would imagine, I don't know about the later series, but this one certainly appears to be one-off stories, which you would think The Twilight Zone comic book would be. And that
should be.
Yeah, should be. And that is definitely the, you know, what you look for in cheap comics.
You
don't have to have the whole series to get the whole story.
I think the hardest part probably of writing these stories is, as they did in this issue, give JMS credit where it's due, is to come up with a story that feels like it's part of the original series, but then subvert expectations and not just have a pat ending to it.
Right. Looks like this one went 12 issues.
So, well, probably cost me a little more than a dollar if I wanted to collect all of them. Might even cost me like $5.
But based on this one, if you see any of these ones cheap, definitely worth a quarter. Totally agree. Right? Weird. I've read probably a half dozen or so now comics in the last few months, just from various cheap bins or stacks that I've pulled them off of, or folks have sent in. So just a weird confluence of events in terms of reading some of these now comics. There you go. Thank you so much for joining, Paul. Always good to talk to you.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
So tell our lovely listeners about all the podcasts that they can tune in to hear you ramble. I mean, ramble coherently. I mean, coherently.
You can find me on Back to the Bins, which is a weekly show in which we review comics and comic-related properties. Been going strong for quite a while. My co-hosts are Scott Gardner and Bill Robinson. And we plan to keep going strong for at least the foreseeable future. I am also the host with various guests on Is It Yours, which is a movie review program where we review current and old movies, one movie per episode, pretty much. That's a labor of love for me. And lastly, we are now wrapping up our coverage of Star Trek Deep Space Nine on the podcast series Listen to the Prophets, where we've gone episode by episode for that series. We are keeping that group alive, though, because now that we've finished recording all our Deep Space Nine episodes, we've started up with Star Trek the Animated Series from the 1970s.
Oh, nice.
We're going to work our way through that, and when we complete that, we'll see where we go from there. I think they're calling it Toon Trek, and I think it's going to have its own feed, so keep your eyes open for that one.
Well, if Andy has his way, it's going to be Knight Rider. I'm just guessing.
Could be Magnum PI.
That's true. So what are you doing in about, say, 25 episodes or so?
I would imagine I'm reviewing a comic book that costs a quarter to buy. You know, this show, the longer this show runs, the harder it's going to be for you to find books for 25 cents.
That has been the case, yes. I confess to that. Always good to talk to you. Thank you, buddy.
Once again, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And that wraps up our coverage of The Twilight Zone number 2, bringing episode 175 to a close. Next time, we are staying independent by covering Ms. Tree's Thrilling Detective Adventures number 1 from Eclipse Comics, cover dated February 1983. So if you have any questions or comments about these issues or the episode, any version of The Twilight Zone, and how does Paul keep getting on the show, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.
Hold on for just a second. Sorry to interrupt you again. Give me a minute.
Yep.
What do we got? Unfortunately, the computer is being used for things that aren't important, like getting a job for the school year. That's more important than me talking about comic books, please.
Priorities.
I generally try to stick to people who are either intelligent or who I can claim they're intelligent because they have jobs that make it sound like they are.
Thank you.
Yeah, he's on the line listening to me. So I figure I might as well insult him while he's listening. He's an economics professor.
Supply meet demand. Demand meet supply.
I would get an A in your class just because I know supply, demand, and fungible.
Oh, yes.
I could probably bribe him to give you a reference. I send him a few free comic books. We get the reference.
I'm not ashamed that I can be bought. I'm ashamed that the price is so low.
I have to tell you, I can totally understand. But, you know, it's what the market will bear. We're back to economics again. Exactly. Professor Allen, he's not a doctor. Please. No, he's lucky he's not unemployed.
That is true.
All right, where were we?
Kids these days prioritizing jobs and the beach over talking about comic books.
Sorry that I gave you a lot of editing to do.
Well, some of that, not all of it, some of that might be an end of show clip.